Today, I have a very special guest on Duologues, someone who has shaped the trajectory of Saint-Gobain in Asia-Pacific and India. An advocate of conscious capitalism, my guest today has led high-impact sustainability initiatives while growing the Saint-Gobain's group business in India faster than the global average. Please join me as I welcome B. Santhanam, CEO of Saint-Gobain Asia-Pacific and India, to this episode of Duologues. Mr. Santhanam, thank you so much for agreeing to do this episode of Duologues with me. And there is so much which we can talk, but to begin with, let me ask you a question which is related to something which you are very passionate about, something which a lot of Indians do not pronounce it the way we are supposed to pronounce it, the company which you are leading. I understand the right pronunciation is something like Saint-Gobain.
Correct. You're absolutely right. In India, pick it up very quickly.
In India, we call it Saint-Gobain.
Okay.
You know, and so you have been a marathoner and you look still very fit, which essentially is a reflection of the activity which you get engaged into. You're a voracious reader yourself, a product of IIT Madras, IIM Ahmedabad. There is so much to your credit. We'll talk all about it later, but to begin with, give us a sense of the background of this company. I understand that it originated in France, and how the journey has been. Is there a background around this very interesting name of it?
Sure.
And the entry into our country and beyond.
Yeah, it's an absolutely fascinating story. You know, you would be very surprised. Saint-Gobain was founded in 1665.
Oh.
Just to give you an idea, Taj Mahal was completed in 1643. It was basically started by Colbert, who created this concept of mercantilism.
Mm-hmm.
What today China, Korea, Japan, and hopefully India is doing is really what Colbert laid out, that the state has to support new industries in the initial phase, provide them with those days, now it's not possible, monopoly. So the King Louis XIV invited and got a lot of glassmakers from Venice, Italy, to come. So they provided wine and shelter, a living condition, in a place called Saint-Gobain.
Okay.
It's a village north of Paris.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we started. And nearly 300 years, we had a manufacturing activity going on in that place. Of course, we don't have it anymore. In India, we really came in sometime in 1996. And I was working for a company which came into the fold of Saint-Gobain.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, Saint-Gobain acquired a large ceramics and abrasives multinational called Norton, which
right.
is also a very iconic company.
Absolutely.
It invented abrasives.
Yeah.
So that company was acquired in 91 in the US. And Norton had a subsidiary in India, a 40% subsidiary
right.
in India. And it became a 51 subsidiary, Granville Norton. I actually started my career in Granville Norton as a management trainee. And in 96, when this became, I was given this opportunity to study what possible investments can Saint-Gobain have in India.
Right.
So that is what led to Saint-Gobain coming to India. So we did some really interesting work, and I would say path-breaking work at that point in time. We looked at this, what we call as flat glass for architectural, automotive, and solar. That's what the company that you're familiar with. So one thing led to another that we decided to invest in India in the flat glass. And I was very surprised. I was chosen as a managing director for that. And I was all of 1639 at that point in time. And it was not very common those days. I was very surprised because we've never had a non-French lead this business, which was already close to 325 years even then. So one thing led to the other. But for us, the challenge was, how do we really present Saint-Gobain in India?
Right.
That's when we decided that we have to be very different from our competitors. And there were Japanese and American and a little bit of Chinese origin competitors in India even then. So we were entering as the fourth or the fifth player.
Right.
It was a crowded market. Everyone was bleeding. Everybody said that, what the hell are you doing? So that's when we realized that we need to really build a brand that was basically innovative and differentiating. And that's what led to the iconic set of advertisements. And many of this start with a very simple premise. You know, what do you want glass to do? We asked hundreds of people a very simple question in 96, 97. They just said that, okay, it provides a transparent difference between outside and inside, and it should be clear. And then we found out that the existing manufacturers had glass which was slightly with a tinge.
Right.
It had some bluish tinge or a greenish tinge. Yeah. There were some distortions because they were not manufacturing it very well. So we appropriated this property clarity. Okay. It's like a generic property like what Xerox.
Right.
Today when you say photocopying, you say Xerox is photocopying.
The core value.
Yeah. Yeah. So the same thing with Colgate, no?
Right.
It's freshness.
Yeah.
So fresh. Now no one else can go and occupy that space.
True.
So we wanted to occupy this clarity,
right?
Distortion-free clarity. And we kind of gave an analogy to the diamond. The diamond has clarity, cut, consistency, and color. So the glass has the same properties as diamond. And we said that we need to go beyond clarity and consistency and distortion-free. So we got that done. Those are very good. It lends itself for mirrors.
Absolutely.
You know, because you want distortion-free mirrors.
Yeah.
And you have clear mirrors.
Yeah.
Then we moved into the solar control glasses, like what you see there.
Right.
Cuts down. So we had something, lets in light, cuts out heat.
Right.
It's a very,
right,
very, very elemental simplicity in whatever we did.
Yeah.
We did it frugally. And that's the reason why today, sometimes there are many recruits that we have. They were 7 or 8 years old at that time. One of the reasons they joined us is because of the advertisement that they saw when they were kids.
Right.
Okay. So that's where the brand got built up. And Saint-Gobain is a fairly, you could call it as a company in several areas. So we are in building materials, glass is important, ceilings are important, insulation. Today this room is got acoustic insulation.
Very insulated,
Yeah, so this, you see all of this acoustic insulation. Then we make construction chemicals, we make ceramics, abrasives. So we are in a range of businesses, every one of that systematically developed in India over the last 25 years.
Wonderful.
So that's...
So elemental simplicity you called, but in my opinion, you are trying to solve complex problems in a very simple manner. And a lot of things you spoke about, element of surprise when you were entrusted this responsibility to lead this company. How did this change you? Because it's safe to assume that such surprises quite often infuse a very large sense of responsibility in individuals, which are almost a tectonic shift the way they think before such entrusting of responsibility happens. And you being an engineer and a product of IIM Ahmedabad would have been wired in a certain manner before this responsibility would have come into you. Did this change after that?
Yeah.
Did you fundamentally being a professional change after this responsibility was entrusted to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I was reasonably successful in my first 16 years. I became the head of sales and marketing and product development. I was doing the P&L in the previous company, in Granville Norton, where I'm still the managing director of that company. It's a publicly listed company. So I think I actually expected that I'll be heading sales and marketing because I knew glass is a much larger market.
Absolutely.
But the fact that I was asked to be a managing director was a huge leap of faith.
Indeed.
And it was in 96.
Yes.
Today, I would say that it's more common,
right?
But and you also gone through a very similar such
similar, but not
experience.
At that age. You were much younger.
Yeah.
That
so and also a pre period where experience was measured in ages.
Right.
And it was a hugely new technology oriented industry process, whereas I'm used to discrete manufacturing, which is what abrasives and ceramics are. Whereas this is process industry, we had to do several things very well. So what it changed me was I was always competitive. Okay, I shifted to a collaborative mode. I shifted to a mode where I had to deal with huge amount of uncertainty and ambiguity.
Right.
So this is the very big shift. I was in a zone where I had everything I knew. I had some 200 people working under me in Grindwell Norton in sales and marketing and product engineering. I knew them by name, by family, by history. It was a very well-defined job.
Right.
And I was doing quite well. And there was also the period India was doing very well. You know, the liberalization was 91 to 93.
True.
And then 93 to 96, we were doing very well. Because we chose three states to explore. One was Maharashtra, which is because we were comfortable with that. And then Rajasthan, which we looked at Kota, because that area has got good raw materials, minerals for that. And Chennai.
Okay.
And Chennai was not in the radar. But the government really, you know, put out a red carpet treatment for us. And one thing led to the other. So really dealing with external bodies who are not under your influence and control.
Absolutely.
Was really a, what we would call as an out-of-the-body experience.
Right.
For someone who's been schooled in,
yeah,
deeply knowledgeable about internal issues of the company,
data,
the businesses.
Analytics.
Yeah. So this was a, and I went through a fairly challenging period because a lot of my well-wishers said that, what are you doing?
Right.
I know that you become a managing director, but this industry is collectively bleeding for the last 5 years. So I moved from a compete mode, you know, intense competitiveness that we all have,
right,
in colleges and,
yeah,
other thing, to a collaborative mode.
True.
And also building mode rather than managing mode.
I believe a lot of entrepreneurs today, the founders of startups and entrepreneurs, they face similar circumstances, situations, you know, at a very early age with so much of potential within them and the opportunity which exists around. You know, they try to charter a territory which is not, you know, walked enough within,
yeah,
our country. And similar situations they may also encounter. And in my own case, when I look back, I believe that the journey essentially can be divided into three phases. The initial phase was about my own ambition.
Correct.
And something which I was like aspiring to be. And then the second phase of my career, after a certain level of accomplishment, so to say, would be about resilience. Situations which sometimes would be beyond your control, and how do you encounter and convert those adversities into opportunities to consistently fuel your ambition. And the third phase of my professional life would be about a sense of humility starting to creep in, a sense of responsibility to do more for others, which eventually creates that very positive spiral in your life to fulfill what you really aspire for the remaining part of your professional and the life itself. So I think this is the kind of framework which,
correct,
I have understood,
yeah,
yet far.
It's an absolutely
continuing to learn in this particular domain. You know, I understand that you have a lot of interest into behaviors, psychology of people, and behavioral economics and those kind of topics. Let's circle back to that one. Do you see a fundamental shift happening? Because I have had my half of my career into the age which we can call was the analog age.
Correct.
And now we are into a digital age. The information is flowing much more faster than what it used to be in the recent past. And with the advent of social platforms, today peer comparisons, reflection of your activity, the judgment which happens by way of those reflections by the outside world, many of whom you are not necessarily directly connected, creates that sense of consistent comparison in people's mind.
Correct, yeah.
In some sense, I'm not very sure that the human mind itself or the brain itself is ready for this kind of hyperactivity.
Hmm.
But I believe that the rate of change itself is changing now in the current times. Have you witnessed the behavior of people changing comparative to what it used to be in the past, say before the digital age came into existence and now?
Yeah, I think it is true. I think there is really almost a tectonic shift in many things that are happening. So what digitalization has done, I mean, is really accelerated the time frame in which you do things.
Right.
I think that's really the single most important thing.
Right.
Today, what took us a year to do something, today it's possible for us to do it in 1 week.
Right.
So you need to have a certain agile mind to grasp that.
Right.
And that's a bit of a, so we are trying to grasp that in some sense, that in the innovation that we try to do, we try to separate the group.
Right.
So I think you, for leaders today, we need to be really bimodal.
Right.
We need this stable, developing, solidly growing group, which is managed by process discipline, by systematic way of doing it. And you have people who have that kind of bent of mind.
Right.
And then you need to really break this into the innovators, innovating group, which is really agile, doing a lot of experimentation.
Right.
So I sense this. We've always done things slightly differently. So that is number one. The other one that you talked about is behavioral economics is something which I got introduced in the late 80s, I was always reading a lot. So the behavioral economics is deeply intertwined in the way we do things in our company.
True.
We recognize that you have to present ideas, anchor them, and let that build rather than go and make a change. Here, I'm the boss. You better get it done. That hierarchical command control mode has moved to nudge mode. And I think that is what is a big shift that is taking place.
Right.
And the time frame. But a large company like ours, we have to do both well. We have to be bimodal.
Right.
We have to get the solid, disciplined part of what we do very well.
Right.
And the innovative part, which is fueled by digital, very well.
So coming back to the capabilities and the opportunities which you are looking at within the country, one, where does India fit in the global story?
Yeah.
And second is, we all understand, and this is very true for us at Panasonic also, that we do not necessarily consider India as an opportunity. It definitely is a huge opportunity, and we are potentially at the cusp of that explosion of opportunity in the next few years' time. We also consider India as a capability.
Correct, yeah.
And we understand that IT is a huge talent in the country. And from here, we are building GCC capabilities, offshore development centers to
be able
to cater to other subsidiaries of Panasonic elsewhere. So one, where does India fit into the global story for you? And second is, how do you look at building more capabilities? I understand that you have a very ambitious investment plan lined up for the next midterm.
Correct.
So give us a sense of all
that. So I think India has been, in some sense, the apple of the eye of Saint-Gobain.
Okay.
So just to give you that, in the last 2 decades, I would say that we made some big investments between 97 and 2002. 2002 was our first year, so we grew 20x in turnover, roughly 17% CAGR year on year.
Impressive.
And we grew our profits by 33%, 33x, okay, 21% CAGR. So essentially, what for Saint-Gobain, this was a huge positive surprise.
Yeah.
Because you can grow, you know, all of us can grow turnover very well in a newly developing country and economy. But to be able to do that and still maintain our good profitability, for instance, we are running at about 30% return on investment in India, which is better than the global averages by a fairly sizable margin. So essentially, so India is the apple of the eye. And we said all our businesses have to reach certain level of profitability sooner than later.
Right.
That was the only assumption that we had. It's not that, but all of them come together. So India is like Panasonic. You know, Panasonic, you may be $3 billion, but Panasonic is massive, right?
Yeah.
How much?
Huge, 80.
80, so you're 4%.
Yeah.
We're exactly that.
Right.
We're exactly that in India.
Right.
We're only 3 to 4% of the world. But in terms of the capital that's coming into India, okay, we are like 15%.
Wonderful.
And last year, we actually became the third most profitable country in the world in absolute terms. Small, but third most profitable. We are, after US, France, India is the third most profitable country. Not in relative terms, but in absolute euro or dollar terms.
Right.
So I think, so therefore there's a very high credibility for all the business leaders that I'm only an example, but there are quite a few people. And so the India story is really
wonderful,
positive, just like it is for many other multinationals.
Yeah.
So first we came to India for its market, for its demand. Then we discovered the talent pool of India.
Right.
The first factory that we built in Chennai, we had a team of 40 people, out of it 30 were expatriates. The last factory which we built in Bibadi had no expatriates, and the team size was half.
Wonderful.
So we discovered the engineering talent. We discovered manufacturing talent. These were the early periods. So the world-class manufacturing used to be run out of many of the talented people. So from being a market, profitable market, growing market, today we are seen as a talent pool, be it engineering, science, manufacturing, new business models, or innovation, or digital.
Wonderful.
I think this is India's story.
Yeah, it is indeed. You know, you spoke about initiatives into environment, energy, conversation and stuff like that. What's your view on sustainability and how are you building capabilities to ensure sustainability continues to remain central to all what happens here?
So, sustainability is a very, very important pillar. So today, for instance, if you do any new product, new solution, new manufacturing, if the pillar of sustainability and the pillar of digital is not there, we don't touch it.
Okay.
So when we look at sustainability, we do in actually two buckets.
Okay.
Basically, sustainable supply chain, which is manufacturing, operations, and other thing. We're doing a huge amount of work. And then sustainable solutions. Okay, the solutions which help you save energy, reduce resources. And I'll give some examples.
Sure.
In the sustainable processes, remember that we use a lot of energy, mostly energy coming from natural gas and energy coming from electricity. So by 2024, 70% of our electrical energy consumption of something like 400 million kilowatt hours in India, 70% of that will come from renewable sources.
Incredible.
70%. And what is fantastic for India, and this is the story that I want to talk about in many places, is that this renewable energy is coming at a lower cost.
Mm.
At a lower cost. Today, for instance, let's say that in your factories, you'll be paying 9 or 10 rupees per kilowatt hour.
Yeah.
Our average cost will come down to 6 rupees in 2024 end.
Right.
Because these renewable energies are coming with this. So therefore, that is one.
Yeah.
The second thing that we're doing is we're electrifying our process.
Sure.
Our furnace melting and many of our processes, we're moving, if it was oil, we're moving to gas. If it was gas, we're moving to electricity. Our kilns and ovens are moving into electricity. Because I really believe, and Sangamam believes, that we can, if you electrify your process, you can find a source of electricity in India, which is green.
Okay. Yeah.
Because we have abundant sun. And then every product that we, today, solution that we have, we look at it as, we go through a process called eco-innovation.
Okay.
Are we using less materials?
Mm-hmm.
Are we using less resources?
Mm.
Are we recycling? And is it saving energy?
Right.
So both sustainable process and sustainable solutions, we are coming in.
Okay.
A full third of our portfolio in R&D and innovation is dedicated only to sustainability.
Right.
Okay. We have several lighthouse projects in India which are driving sustainability.
Right.
So there is a huge amount. So sustainability is really coded in our DNA.
Wonderful.
Now.
No, this is much needed actually. You know, from my point of view, the tiny understanding within my own space is that, you know, we quite often don't consider the total cost of ownership of the residential or the commercial spaces where we live in.
Correct. Yeah.
And when it comes to backward integration, you know, in these segments or applications, products, the portfolio which you deal with, is that a challenge when you look forward to, because need and the necessity of our country is to ensure that we value add in what we do here.
Correct.
And therefore, backward integration is necessary. So you need to have a better understanding and control of the supply chain, including of the materials,
correct,
the minerals, if at all they are used, and stuff like that. What is your reflection
on that? We are the first company, when we came into, we realized that we have to own our raw materials.
Okay.
So we process our own sand, we process our own dolomite, we process our own limestone. And today we are looking at alternate low CO2 emitting raw materials. So we have sand processing plant in Tamil Nadu, Andhra Pradesh, Gujarat, Rajasthan. And so to me, it's not just the supply chain reliability, but also quality.
Right.
I strongly believe, I think you have in India, you have to go both upstream and downstream,
right,
for you to be successful. Sometimes multinational companies are not happy with that. They say that let's find some partners who will do the raw material.
True.
It took some time for me to convince that we have to own our own, right, raw material space, yeah, and not leave it to some partner. Then at, yeah, some point in time, you have a challenge. So this is a, right, different, you know, approach that we made in India. You are absolutely right.
Right. Moving on to the next part of the conversation, your life itself. And I believe something which will overlap this would be the question that you've been consistently with this organization for more than 4 decades, which might be very unusual for a lot of people, including myself. In my 28 years, this is my fourth company, while I'm being very consistent.
But you've been consistent to the product,
yeah,
industry,
to the industry,
market industry,
yeah,
because,
sure,
you're able to transfer
to the
your
thought
insight.
Process, to,
correct,
for my intent and things like that. So I want to really understand from you that how could you deliver this kind of consistency in your professional career, being with an organization, you know, contributing so much both for the organization and for the industry and therefore for the country for 4 decades is no mean feat. How,
yeah,
could you do that?
So I think one is the advantage that we have,
yeah,
to some extent even Panasonic,
yeah,
and other companies have, is you're not just in one business.
True.
You're in a,
yeah, multiple,
variety,
very,
of business.
Very diverse.
Just look at it.
Yeah.
Panasonic.
90, yeah.
70, 50% of your
business divisions.
Yeah, yeah, and
thousands
so
of products.
So therefore, actually, when you work for a company like Panasonic or Saint-Gobain, you're actually working for multiple industries.
True.
So that's a
fair point.
See, and if you build credibility in this, and if you're known to the leadership that you're a credible leader, manager initially,
they will
leader,
invest in you.
And you develop new businesses, then you keep,
yeah,
you have,
yeah,
several opportunities.
Right.
So for me, I've talked about this to my teams. See, what do we really look for as individuals? One is we need, the company has to grow.
Right.
See, look, we True. Need non-linear,
yeah,
growth,
yeah,
for meeting our material
aspiration. Yeah.
There is no doubt about it. I think that's very important. I don't think anyone should underscore that. I think all of us aspire for a non-linear growth in our thing. We're not happy with the annual change of 7 or 8 or 10%, which the Western world would be happy with 2 or 3%.
Right.
Okay. Now, I think that means we have to be part of a group which is going non-linearly.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the important things that Saint-Gobain was.
Right.
Saint-Gobain grew from X to 20X in,
right,
the last 20 years. So anyone who is associated with Saint-Gobain, if they're strong leaders,
grew,
they
can
lift
rate.
It up.
True.
So that's something which is important, that as youngsters, they have to understand, am I part of a growing portfolio or am I part of a growing industry? If I'm a startup, I'm part of a growing industry, or am I looking at a large pie which is possible, even if it is intensely competitive.
Right.
So I look at it in very simple terms, and I have a simple framework for how you look at your own career. I said, first you look for the role. Is the role something which you like, something which excites you to get up and do it, and something which you are cut out for? There are many people who have exciting job, but they're not cut out for that. So your competence, your capabilities, your skill sets, and that match with that. So that's the first role.
Okay.
And secondly, is a company willing to give you responsibility?
Sure.
Right? Are they saying that, hey, go get this done, and along with that authority. And the third one I see is respect. The third R is I see is respect. Are you respected for something that you bring to the table? So I think deep expertise is respected.
Right.
Whatever be the expertise, creating a company, creating a brand, creating new product markets, whatever it is.
Right.
Then you see a recognition. Is the company recognizing you? I think, or the industry recognizing you? And then you want to see results.
Absolutely.
You want to produce results because you want to grow. You want tangible results because results are a proof that you got the right role, you got the right responsibility, you did the right expertise. Result is an outcome. That's
absolutely
important. And I don't think we can exclude that.
Yeah.
And the last is rewards follow this.
True.
If you have these five, the rewards follow.
Right.
I keep telling whatever youngsters, okay, there are outliers, we'll do something outstanding. But a large number of the people, are these six R's aligned?
Agreed.
If you put the reward ahead of respect and expertise, then you are in trouble.
True.
Sooner or later, the world will find out that you don't have expertise.
True. Yes.
So these are role, responsibility, respect, recognition, result, reward. I think that is, those have been aligned for me right through.
Right.
So it's incredible that it's the 44th year that I'm working for the same group. I worked in abrasives, ceramics, glass, now gypsum, insulation, construction chemicals, homes, and then multiple countries.
My reflections are very similar. And apart from this, what I believe, if at all, we have to say converge to something which I call as intelligent gut feel. This differentiates us from a lot of people. And this essentially means our ability to imagine and precipitate data and consume it and then utilize our gut feeling.
Correct.
To drive decisions.
Yeah.
You know, that sets us apart,
that's basically insight.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the reasons why quite a lot of the startups, they start with an insight. And I think many of them are analytical by nature, right?
Right.
Sundar Pichai, everybody was analytical people, come from analytical factories.
Right.
Like IITs or RECs or any one of this. But I think that insight that you develop, which is based on your instinct or gut feel, as you call it.
Yeah.
I think that's a very important thing. But I believe that we can grow sensibly and sustainably, India.
Yeah.
That's what I'm, you know, if I have to tell, India can grow sensibly and sustainably. We don't have to be in a tearing hurry to break down the society apart. And
We are getting there.
Yeah.
We are getting there. So moving on to the earlier part of your life, I mean, how did it look like? What was your earlier part, the childhood, when you were growing up? Why did IIT happen? Why did IIM happen? I mean, give us a sense
of
that.
So it's fine. One, I come from a family which is relatively well off by those days. My father was a doctor. So the first 10 years of my life was really bliss.
Okay.
Purely experience, exploration. We were used to time, life, and we were living in a district headquarters. My father was very progressive, conservative but liberal.
Okay.
Conservative in terms of all the views that we have,
the
in conservative
systems.
Value systems, every single thing, but liberal in terms of, I learned a little bit of Sanskrit, I did all of that stuff.
Wonderful.
But liberal in terms of exposure to the world. So therefore, we had this incredible experience and exploratory thing. And I was naturally more comfortable with the quantitative part. My elder brother was naturally very comfortable with, used to dissect frog even when he was 8 or 10. So he went into medicine, he went into Jipmer, Pondicherry, and I was said that this guy will be more in the analytical area. But then my father died at the age of 10. So our life took a very, very, from a very blissful thing. Now we are in a period, we have to get our act together. So it was purely focused on academic excellence. And that led to IIT because I wrote IIT entrance exam and was lucky to be there. And then IIT Madras happened. Actually, IIT Madras made a huge difference. I entered IIT at the age of 16. So very formative period. it made a dramatic difference because you meet outliers every day. Not outliers in science and maths, but outliers in debate, outliers in quiz, outliers in... We had the best jazz group. We had the best Western musical group. So I think that, and then IIM is a very natural outcome because I had opportunities to go out, but someone said that IIM is a thing, and IIM Ahmedabad was seen as amongst the better ones at that time. We had four IIMs, at the three IIMs, Cal, Bangalore, and this. I got into all three.
Right.
So it was a very natural progression. One thing led to the other. IIT was quantitative excellence. IIM was qualitative. thing. So these two combined together,
right?
And then the work happened.
Yeah, yeah, potent combination. And you know, you look fit. I know that you've run marathons and
half marathons.
Half marathons, and you know, I have not even run that yet.
You look fit enough to run a marathon. This is the right age to
do that.
I'll do
that in the time to come. And you know, there are multiple aspects of any individual. In very simple sense, it might be the physical, emotional, say spiritual, if not beyond. How do you maintain a balance between these various aspects of being an individual? You are physically, you look fit, and life is always such that you know, it can throw uncertain situations to individuals. Ability to maintain sanity under variety of circumstances, whether it is success or challenges, is something which most of the people aspire to. So give us a reflection of your life, that how do you maintain that sanity, that consistency dealing with variety of situations? How do you keep yourselves fit? How do you keep that mental ability
Correct.
Fit to be able to take up challenges and, of course, the opportunities what life throws to you?
So I have this, of course, all of us have gone through periods of where I've been tested massively.
Yeah.
Early stages, I remember at least four or five phases of my life where 1 or 2 years have been extremely difficult. And that's where you talked about the resilience.
Yes.
So what is the abiding faith that I have with me as well as my colleagues is that we can ride it out.
Okay.
So there is this feeling, look, if it's tough for you, it's tough for a lot of people who are in the same space.
True.
Okay?
Yeah.
If it's in a very analogically, if there is a tough paper and you're finding it tough, all your classmates are also going to fight it tough.
I've gone through
that. Okay? So I believe that we can make a differentiation.
Right.
So therefore, there is an intense competitive nature which tells me, stay immersed, stay engaged, and you will be able to come out of this. And I think that has been, at least in four or five phases of my career, I've always seen that with the right kind of collaborative teams that we have, I think it's possible for us to be able to do that. So therefore, that's the resilience phase is where you stay immersed and you are able to find a solution, because that's important. The second, which I want to, which is somewhat different from the Western world, is Western world sees work and life as
separate
compartments,
yes,
separate.
Right. Yeah, right.
I can't mix these two. Friday, 4 o'clock, bye, and don't call me. Whereas
it's all life.
Yeah. For me, work life is a holistic fusion.
True.
Okay. I don't think I can have a life if my work is in a mess, or work when my life is in a mess. And I think here is where I think a lot of people. So for me, I'm lucky, and unfortunately, she's not here today because she's working. And my wife has been a professional, and she was in software, TCS, at a fairly senior position. Now she runs a company focused on bringing professional women back to work.
Okay.
So she's focused. Okay. She's got a small startup, and she works in the IIT Madras Research Park ecosystem. And she's been a kind of mirror for me right through. And first, to say that you are not God's gift to mankind, which is one kind of a mirror. Other one is, all times when you go through nagging doubts, outcomes, I think you have someone who's been there.
Yeah.
That's a huge support. Then other support, which I think, I don't know whether you are included. So we have this Young President's Organization. I became part of it in the early 40s.
I understand, yes.
And And today, of course, I'm in the other category there. But we have a private board of 8 entrepreneurs. We've been together for 20 years. We throw at them our problems of family, personal, or business. Personal could be health. Family could be my son is struggling. I have challenges with my wife. I have problems with my parents. And I have these kind of issues. And business, I'm messed up right now. I'm in trouble.
Right.
I think this network, we meet every month.
Wonderful.
And they provide the support. They give you saying that we have gone through that. The moment, you know, Manish, that you recognize that since I'm older to you by 16 years,
right. Yeah.
Okay, if you get that from me, hey, Manish, I've gone through that. Stay there.
Good enough.
You know, you will come out of it.
Yeah.
That gives you that confidence.
Yeah,
so I think this is it. So the network, the family support system, and the confidence, not bordering on arrogance, the confidence that if you stay engaged, you can come out of this.
Wonderful.
I think this keeps you in balance.
Right.
And the other thing that you talked about, which I liked about, is humility. Over a period of time, confidence should not lead to arrogance.
True.
So what I think today, I like this oxymoron, is confident humility.
Yeah.
How are you confident, and how do you combine with genuine humility that I don't know many things? I can't do many things by myself. I do not have the insight in this area. I need help. I need to collaborate with others. I need my teams to support me in this. So this confident humility kind of balance between this is important. So therefore, this is the kind of thing that has helped me.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure that it's the same for everyone.
Exactly the same for me, actually.
Oh,
all
that's
the aspects
fantastic.
What you spoke. And you know what I've observed is that while almost every individual would have unique traits, but there is something which cuts across common, and that part is what you just mentioned. This kind of cuts across with a lot of people. So I can very much relate with that.
True. I think and I think the family support and the professional support that I receive from the YPO. Okay, we have a thing called forum. We discuss something where you can discuss with absolute confidentiality. Yeah. It's not going to go out with the 8 people.
Right.
So you can be vulnerable there.
Absolutely.
Your confidence in your ability to ride out, your ability in your teams, a family support, and an external professional support like what I've had.
Right.
And that has really helped a lot.
Yeah, yeah. This is going to help a lot of people, what you just said.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for saying that. Are there some people you look up to, or in the past when you were growing up, your professional ladder, you've looked up to people
Correct.
Who have been mentors to you, or sort of you've looked up to being like one?
Yeah. So there are there are 3 people who have been mentors. I have a slightly different take on role models.
Sure.
I'll come to that later.
Yeah.
The first thing is I started in information technology.
Right.
The first 2 years I spent doing systems development and coding.
Right.
I didn't like it. I moved into market development. There was an iconic guy called Joy Kuti who took me under his wings.
Okay.
And I have this quantitative background and systems development background. What am I going to do in marketing? Not very different from what you did, right?
Similar, yeah.
So it's fantastically similar.
Right.
But he kind of kindled that understanding of market and customer that I had. And he was able to kindle the creative part of me, which I didn't know existed before. I didn't know that I had a bit of creativity. I had a bit of understanding of consumer psychology and market. I didn't know it. He made that happen. And then he is now 80, and he's still, I'm in touch with him. He was way ahead of his time. You know, he used to think of adjacencies were not seen, when core competency was a mantra. He said, no, you have to be in adjacencies. In India, you have to be in adjacency. You cannot just be in a core area. That was in the 80s. Then I had this managing director of Grindwell Norton,
okay.
Anand Mahajan, and he's also from the family which has a 6%+ stake in Grindwell Norton. So he gave me opportunities. And he also backed me when I was when my back was to the wall. Okay, he used to give me really good support when I was down and out.
Right.
Okay, when I faced a professional challenge, a leadership challenge, he provided me the nurturing and the support that I believe in you. And he was instrumental in me becoming the managing director,
right,
because he said, why does this guy have to be a sales and marketing head for the new glass entity? Why can't he be the managing director? That triggered the thought process in the French. So these are, and then there was a French person called Jacques Aschenbrough.
Mm-hmm.
He was heading the global, he was the president of the flat glass in Saint-Gobain. And he later on became the chairman of Valeo, and he's now the chairman of Orange. He and I struck chord. He had an incredible faith in emerging economies, and we struck a chord. And therefore, these three people were really great mentors for me.
Wonderful.
I've always had role models from colleagues and people who reported to me. There are some people who are process disciplined. I like that. There are some people who are able to implement systematically. So for me, role models are those who walk around us. Okay, who in specific areas, they have huge strength, which you can absorb. So that's, to me, every day there are people who are role models who are walking around us. So I think we have role models walking around us.
Right.
We just ignore them.
Right. Yeah,
it did not be a... In there be a CEO of a large company, $5 billion company.
True.
It can be anybody.
Yeah, anybody. So this brings me to the last question, which potentially might be my purpose of doing Duologues, is to understand what is that higher purpose which lets people do what they do. And, you know, you've achieved so much in your life, and there would be a purpose which would have existed at different phases of life. Today, at the position you are within the society, within the organization, as individual, what is that higher purpose which wakes you up every morning and something which you look forward to?
Yeah, so, okay, I've always had this, but over the last, say, 15 years ago, I wrote something on this. And that kind of sums up what I'm by nature, okay, and by development. Which is really that I strongly believe in conscious capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you would have heard the term quite often.
Yeah. During my research, I found this particular term which you mentioned.
Yeah, yes. So it was actually coined by an Indian.
Okay.
In, I think, Stanford, I don't remember exactly. The conscious capitalism really, it came sometime in the mid-2000s. Because till that time, in 1973, Milton Friedman said, the only purpose of an organization or a firm is to make profits for shareholders.
Right.
And that kind of obliterated any other thought processes about about what the purpose of an organization.
Of, yeah.
So it was kind of jarring for me. I'm not saying that I don't choose profits. So for me, I think, can you combine passion, people, planet, and then turn profits. So it's really that the passion to do something, which
Wonderful.
I think anything connected with the environment was passionate for
Wonderful.
Me. But can you combine people and planet part of it?
Right.
So therefore, I'm really lucky to be heading a company which talks about sustainable and light and sustainable construction.
Absolutely.
So for me, this passion is there. Panasonic is part of Matsushita, right?
Yes.
Do you know that there used to be an institute called PHP Institute?
Yeah.
Peace,
so,
Harmony and Prosperity.
Oh, you know about that.
Yeah. So therefore, I was really inspired by the PHP Institute's output in the 1980s.
Wow.
So for me, purpose, passion, people, planet and profits is the order of what we have to do.
Wonderful.
And I, in fact, when I was leading the Southern Region, CII, I was the chairman for Southern Region.
Right.
The slogan in that is conscious capitalism for that.
Wonderful.
I said, we need to take care of stakeholders. Yes, we have to make sure that our shareholders are happy. otherwise they'll throw us out.
Right.
Keep them happy to the extent
course,
that they don't throw you out.
Right.
But take care of the stakeholders, employees, people around your factories, government, society, take care of that. So that is, to me, it's working well. And I'm extremely happy that that part of it, I don't have to get up and say I'm messing the world.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. That is important. So this alignment of purpose, passion, people, planet, profit.
Yeah.
I think that is a driving one.
Right.
I think it finds itself an element as conscious capitalism.
Wonderful.
Yeah. We invest a lot on ecology. You know, we have in Chennai, we have 150,000 trees in our 177-acre property.
Wow.
Urban forest. We have 2 rainwater harvesting reservoirs, 14 crore liters of water we use, 60% of our water comes from our roof.
Wow.
Okay, in this house, I have 23 kilowatt of solar. Okay, so everywhere we use the water from the well. We don't use chemicals. So I think it is possible for us to be able to manage prosperity through harmony with the environment.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's always easy.
Yeah,
but it's a path that is
it has to
possible.
Be. It has to be,
and that is where I think conscious capitalism comes into play. You bring that consciousness to what capitalism is good, which is delivering outcomes and results for a large number of people in a positive way. If we can combine that, it's wonderful.
Thank you so much. Most of my conversations, I believe, are insightful for a lot of people, inspiring for a lot of people, but this one is, in addition to that, immersive for me personally.
Thank you.
So thank you so much for the conversation, and I wish you all the best for the time to come, and very happy to be hosted at this lovely place. Thank you so much for
Thank you.
Listen to more conversations on Duologues across Spotify, JioSaavn, Apple Podcast, and Google Podcasts.